Each time that I come into Columbia's studio, I find it crowded with interesting visitors. And here I am surrounded by a bevy of young women, each one of whom is playing an important part in this convention. You know, ever since this convention began, we've been introducing to you each day some youngest delegate or youngest alternate. And I find that we've got the youngest of the youngest with us here now. Will you step to the microphone, please, young woman? What is your name?
Sarah Hale.
Sarah Hale, and where are you from?
I'm from Rogersville, Tennessee.
Are you a delegate?
Yes.
And how old are you?
I'm 18.
18 and a delegate?
Yes, sir.
But I'm told that you can't be a delegate unless you're 21.
Well, see, I was elected at a special caucus at the Roosevelt Hotel by the delegates there. Tennessee delegates.
I see, and Tennessee makes an exception to the general rule.
Yes, sir.
Well, have you served well as a delegate?
I don't know. I hope so.
Are you satisfied with the convention?
Oh, yes, sir.
Have you enjoyed it?
I have.
Have you had a good time outside of the convention hall?
Well, I've been here most of the time, I admit.
To have a good time outside of the convention hall?
No, sir.
But you're positive that you are the youngest of the delegates?
No, sir, I'm not really positive, but they tell me that, so I guess I am.
Well, you're certainly the youngest that we've encountered. Thank you very much. Yeah. Now, there's another young woman who's got a badge. I think she's marked Page. Are there lady pages here in the convention hall?
Oh, yes, of course. Several of them.
Really? Well, what do they do in contradistinction to the boy pages?
Oh, they go and interview all of the good-looking men.
Oh, of course. But I see the boy pages interview the girls, and the girl pages interview the men.
Yes.
Well, now, what man did you find most responsive to your interview?
Mr. David Willens, of course.
Ah, yes, of New Jersey.
Yes.
You found him persuasive and eloquent,
yes,
and likable.
Yes, very much.
Where are you from yourself?
I'm from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Well, that's the reason. Tennessee and New Jersey agreed very well together.
Yes, we always do.
Is this the first time you've been at the convention?
Yes, it's the first time I've been to a convention, and the first time I've been a page, and the first time I've broadcast.
Well, I declare, that's a trio of firsts. All right. I hope for the sake of the radio audience that it won't be the last time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, let's see. Here's a young woman that I've seen flitting around on the platform again and again with a book. What were you doing with that book?
Getting autographs.
Getting autographs. What is your name, please?
My name is Mrs. Walter.
And where are you from?
Philadelphia.
Oh, you live in Philadelphia?
Yes.
I see you've got a badge here marked employee. Now, I never saw that before. What are you an employee of?
Well, that was given to me by the editor of the newspaper I work for.
Oh, because you're his employee?
Mm-hmm.
I see, but it has nothing to do with the convention.
No.
Except that it gets you
me
in.
Gets through.
That's the idea. Well, tell me, have you had any interesting experiences in getting those autographs?
Well, I found most of the people I went after very charming, and I went after all the big ones.
You did, and did you get them all?
Everyone I went after except one.
And that was?
The governor of Montana.
What did he say?
He said, I'm too busy.
I declare, how impolite. Well, you try him again. I'm sure that he'll respond.
I will.
And now, Ed Murrow, I see you've got a couple of chaps with you there. Suppose you talk to them.
Well, Hans Kaltenborn, I've just returned from the barber shop. And as you know, the barber shop is the center of all the informal forums that are to be found in this country. There are probably more interesting, informative, and delightful discussions take place in barber shops than any other single point. Now, here I have the chief of the barber shop here in Convention Hall. Now, I wonder, sir, if you'd tell me your name.
Ernest A. Landy.
Ernest A. Landy. Now, perhaps you'd tell us just a little about what these delegates have talked about as they've sat in the barber chair there and you worked on them.
They usually say that we should stick with our Mayor Wilson. He's a wonderful man. They wish they could stay here a little longer so they could see our big town. And they also are sort of a little disappointed that we haven't got a bar room in our convention hall.
Well, now, what about the matter of the spending of money? Have they been rather liberal in that regard?
Very much so. I have no complaint to make. I've done my share out of it.
Well, now, when you've been cutting the hair of these delegates, have you found that delegates from one region of the country had hair that was perhaps a little longer than those from other regions of the country?
Why, some of them, yeah.
Would you care to specify the region?
Why, some of them are from New Mexico.
Oh, is that so?
Well, now, their hair is sort of a little long, but they were shorter after I got through with them.
Oh, well, that's grand. You were doing your job. Now, have you any other general observations that you'd like to make as a result of your intimate contact with these people in the barbershop? Have you shaved some very distinguished personages in the last two or three days?
Why, yes, sir. I've shaved the governor from several of them.
Well, in any event, it was
the governor. The name, it was several governor, and I also have shaved the Wallace, the gentleman that defended the Lindbergh case.
Well, that must have been very interesting indeed. And
you? I've met several other gentlemen, very interesting. And I wish it was convention here every week.
Thank you very much indeed. And now here again from the barbershop is a gentleman who shines the shoes of the delegates. And I suspect that after those shoes are shined, they immediately go forth upon the floor of the convention and the shine is immediately removed. Now tell us a little about the shoes that you have shined.
It has been ours during this convention to serve the most distinguished people of America. And we trust that during this time that we have served, we have satisfied very well.
Well, I suspect that you perhaps rehearsed or memorized that a little bit. Could you tell us one or two of the distinguished people whose shoes you have shined in the last two or three days?
Governor Lehman of New York and the young Roosevelt, son of the president of our country.
And were they entirely satisfied with the service that they received?
Especially so.
Oh, they were? Well, I'm certainly sure that that must have been the case. And I see standing over here, just at my left, Mr. Percy Winner. Mr. Winner, will you come in, please?
Yes, I'd like to introduce to the radio audience now Mr. Joseph B. Poindexter, Governor of Hawaii. Governor, you've come a long distance, haven't you? How far is it?
We've traveled about 5,000 miles.
Is this your first Democratic convention, Governor?
No, I've had the privilege of attending others.
Many of them?
A few.
Well, how does this one compare with the other ones?
Well, I think this is the most enthusiastic and most inspiring convention that I've ever attended, or it's been held in this country in many years.
And you personally are enjoying it, I take it?
I'm having a great time as a Democrat.
Well, tell me one thing which has interested me. You come from a very beautiful island in the Pacific. How does the sweltering climate inside this auditorium compare with your fine climate in Hawaii?
Well, it's rather depressing in the convention hall. Honolulu climate is never cold. And in the summer, it's never hot. It seldom gets above 85 or below 60. So you can judge for yourself in comparison to what we've had down there this evening.
So despite the fact that you're enjoying this, you'll be very happy to get back to Hawaii.
I'm always glad to get home.
Well, I'd be glad to go there myself. Tell me, Governor, are the people of Hawaii really very interested in what's been going on in Washington during the last few years and the New Deal?
Naturally, because the New Deal has been of great interest, I think, to the whole community, or the whole public. And it's been very beneficial to Hawaii. We're very much interested in it and hopeful that it will continue.
And you personally are a strong supporter of Mr. Roosevelt.
An enthusiastic supporter.
Thank you very much, Governor. Now I see standing here with me a gentleman who comes from a very different part of the world. Will you come up to the microphone? I have with me Mr. Robert Bender, who is a delegate from Alaska. Mr. Bender, you've come a long distance too, haven't you?
Yes, sir, I have.
And how long has it taken you to get here?
Well, it took us about 5 days, 4 days by boat and 24 hours or a little less by plane from Seattle to Washington, D.C., and then from Washington to Philadelphia.
And I understand, and I overheard you a few moments ago speaking with someone in another part of this room. You said that you could get back to Alaska in 26 hours. Is that true?
That's quite true. There's no regular scheduled service between Seattle and Juneau now, but many ships fly back and forth on charter. And should I be fortunate enough to find a charter ship when I arrive in Seattle, it will take me 18 hours from Philadelphia to Seattle, another 8 hours into Juneau, making about 26 hours.
I see. And how are you enjoying this convention?
Very, very much.
Is it your first convention?
No, sir, it isn't. I attended the famous Madison Square Garden convention in 1924, which lasted so long, and we thought we had enthusiasm there. But I think this surpasses it in every way, and the enthusiasm seems real and very vital.
That's very interesting. Tell me now, I'd like to ask you a question about the climate. How do you feel about the climate in this sweltering auditorium? How does it compare with your Alaskan climate?
Well, it's warmer than our summer climate, but we're enduring it very well, and the people of Philadelphia are so kindly that we really forgot climate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bender. Now I'll turn you back to Mr. Morrow.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have here in the studio a man with a mop, but we've been unable to get him to the microphone because he informs us that he has work to do. So we now return you to Mr. Bob Trout in the studio.
In the studios, we've been listening to that unusual program coming from our studio on the second floor of this convention hall while we have sat with our eyes glued to the scene on the floor outside. The delegate from Virginia has just finished his seconding speech, and at this propitious moment, we return you to the rostrum.
Washington! Mr. Roy B. Meisner of the state of Washington. Mr. Chairman,
Ladies and gentlemen, in 1932, the state of Washington had the honor and distinction of being the first state in the Union to pledge and instruct its delegates for Franklin D. Roosevelt. This year, the state of Washington sent 100 of its citizens over 3,000 miles to report to this Democratic convention. The last 3.5 years of leadership under the present administration has resulted in enormous increase in our business, better times for our farmers and fruit growers, and happier and better living conditions for our laborers and workers, many of them being unemployed under the previous administration. Realizing as we do that this work is only half completed, we are here again to pledge the unanimous support of the Washington delegation to our able leader. We promise to deliver the overwhelming vote in November for our President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt.
As the delegates file out of the hall, leaving the alternates to vote in their places in the voting, which will come later in the evening, the roll call passes
West
the state
Virginia,
of Washington.
One of the most brilliant and loyal senators of the United States, Senator M.M. Neely of West Virginia.
Mr. Chairman, and members of the convention, as long as the rights, the aspirations, and the hopes of the common people live, respect, admiration, and affection for Franklin D. Roosevelt and Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt will never die. All the voluminous history of man from the creation to the present hour will be searched in vain for a more courageous, diligent, faithful public servant than the gallant Democratic champion who will soon be nominated by acclamation and re-elected president next November by a majority so vast that it will stun the mind and stagger the imagination. Our confidence in the favorable result of this campaign is the corollary of our conviction that the voters will ever remember what the Hoover administration did to them and never forget what the Roosevelt administration has done for them. At the polls, the people will remember that on the last day of the Hoover administration, every bank in the United States was either closed or under extraordinary restrictions designed to save it from disaster. Industry was prostrate, commerce was paralyzed, business was dead and buried, destitution walked every street, suffering stalked every highway, want waited on every corner, and piteously held out its placeless hands for alms. While the hideous specter of starvation hovering over all the land killed the blood of the bravest and filled the hearts of the stoutest with consternation. Who will ever forget the stock market crash under Mr. Hoover in 1929, which in 2 days annihilated security values that exceeded by billions of dollars the cost of this country's participation in the Great World War? Between that time and the 4th of March 1933, Hooverism wrecked banks, shut down factories, locked up steel mills, embarrassed manufacturers, impoverished merchants, overwhelmed coal operators, pauperized coal miners, ruined farmers, and overran the land with a vast army of unemployed men, destitute women, and hungry children, as numerous as the leaves on the trees, as countless as the grains of sand on the shores of the sea. During the last 3 years of the Hoover administration, more than 1,500,000 city dwellers were robbed of their homes. More than 2 million farmers were robbed of their last acre of land. more than 14 million toilers were robbed of their jobs and scattered over the hills to the poorhouse in torture and tatters and tears. Mr. Hoover promised the American people prosperity. He gave them adversity that bit like a serpent and stung like an adder. And who can guarantee that Mr. Landon's campaign promises will be any better than those of the great engineer? Under Mr. Hoover's administration, when the toilers asked for work, they asked in vain. When they asked for bread, they received a stone. When they begged for a fish, they received a serpent. The Hoover panic exiled our optimism and sowed the seeds of pessimism all over the land. It gave us shadows for our sunshine, tears for our smiles, and sorrows for our joys. It stopped the wheels of industry in 10,000 cities. It silenced the noise of business in 100,000 factories. It put out the fires in 1 million furnaces. It brought idleness, poverty, destitution, and despair to millions of American homes. As a breeder of discontent, the Hoover administration has never had a rival. As a furnace fire extinguisher, it has had no equal since Noah's flood. As a monumental, wiggling, wobbling, blighting failure, the Hoover administration is the supreme masterpiece of all the world. And now upon this reeking record of industrial disaster and economic woe, upon the silent ruins of the long boasted Coolidge prosperity, and over a broad and endless highway of unredeemed pledges, broken promises, and forgotten principles, come the heartless, greedy forces of plutocracy, privilege, and plunder, which neither slumber nor sleep, and insult our intelligence, challenge our sanity, and outrage our sensibility by urging us to adopt again the philosophy of Hooverism, the inferno of disaster, the horror of horrors, the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. But what has the Roosevelt administration done? In Holy Writ, the creation of the universe, including everything from the tiniest grain of sand to the most stupendous star, is described in the sublime and simple language. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The vastness of the accomplishments of the Roosevelt administration make their adequate description impossible, and the emulation of this divine example of brevity indispensable. Therefore, in a word, under this administration, the value of the stocks in corporations held by millions of American voters have increased $31 billion. If this stupendous sum were equally divided among all the people, it would mean more than $237 for every man, woman, and child beneath the American flag. By what kind of arithmetic will the Liberty League demonstrate that this achievement has ruined the country? During this administration, the farmer's cattle, his lambs, his corn, his oats, his wheat, his hogs, and his oats have increased on the average in value more than 97%. During the last 3 years, our national income from such sources as wages, salaries, dividends, and rents has increased more than $19 billion. How discouraging these figures must be to the Liberty League and the old guard of privilege who stand before the wailing wall and cry in vain for more Hooverism, and an issue with which to obstruct the irresistible march of human progress under Franklin D. Roosevelt. Under this administration, the output of the steel industry has increased more than fivefold. The hours of service of skilled workers in the mining industry have been reduced to 7 a day, and the wages have been increased 71%. The compensation of the miners has been increased more than 60%. Do these figures indicate that it would be wise for the people to change the administration of Franklin Roosevelt for 4 more years of Hoover horror? During this administration, increases in prosperity similar to those which have been noted have been enjoyed by every other legitimate industry in the country. But greater than this administration's service to the farmers, greater than its service to the industrialists, greater than its service to the great corporations, greater than the service of promoting the prosperity of all the other people in the land, greater still are the purely humanitarian accomplishments of the President and his Congress during the last 39 months. the employment of child labor in mines and factories that health destroying tasks, which has cursed the world for ages, was abolished by New Deal legislation. The fact that the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, declared the National Recovery Act unconstitutional does not diminish the credit due the president for his bold effort to abolish slavery among those whom the master said, "Suffer little children to come unto me." More than 7 million of those who suffered enforced idleness. More than 7 million of those who suffered enforced idleness under Hoover have been placed on payrolls by the Roosevelt administration. Tonight, return and still returning Roosevelt prosperity is seen in the flames of the furnace and the fire of the forge, in the field of the farmer and the output of the manufacturer, in the smoke of industry that dims the sun by day and hides the stars by night. Roosevelt prosperity is heard in the ring of the anvil and the rumble of the locomotive, in the whir of the spindle and the click of the shuttle, in the sound of the hammer and the hum of the saw, from the wheat fields of the north to the cotton fields of the south, from the lumber camps of Washington to the orange groves of Florida, from the great financial empire of the opulent east to the great agricultural kingdom of the golden west, Roosevelt prosperity, irresistible and all-pervading, is bestowing its blessings and its bounties upon all the children of men. The great man in the White House, with the assistance of his Congress, has housed the homeless, employed the idle, enriched the wealthy, fed the hungry, clothed the naked, and blessed the poor. What Moses was to the children of Israel on their departure from bondage, what Joshua was to the favored people upon their entrance into the land of promise, what Charles Martel was to Christianity in the great contest between the crescent and the cross, Franklin D. Roosevelt has been to the American people in the greatest crisis that ever confronted a great country since the morning stars sang together. He has been a godsend. This is the last page. He has been a godsend to the republic whose government he has spiritualized and whose brutal, blighting materialism he has banished forever. He has rekindled the fires of patriotism and righteousness in the hearts of 125 million American people. He is leading the way as fast as humanly possible to the realization of Pope's dream of the Messiah, when all crime shall cease and ancient fraud shall fail, descending justice lift aloft her scale, peace o'er the world her olive wand extend, and white-robed innocence from heaven descend. West Virginia, West Virginia moves that this convention nominate by acclamation, and that the people elect by unanimous consent for their next president that illustrious man who in time of fiery trial and frightful tribulation has been a spring of ice-cold water to the burning lips of thirst, a palm that lifts its coronet of leaves above the desert sand, an isle of green in some far distant sea, the purple light of dawn above the eastern hills, a cloud of gold beneath the setting sun, a fragrance wafted from an unseen shore, a silvery strain of music heard within some palace wrought of dreams. Franklin D. Roosevelt of New York.
As delegates one by one leave the sweltering heat of the hall, Chairman Robinson makes some attempt to enforce the five-minute limit on seconding speeches, and you heard the last speaker interrupt to say this is the last page as the chairman approached his elbow. Wisconsin, says the reading clerk. Back to the rostrum as the chairman pounds the gavel.
The hour is growing very late. The chair again takes the liberty of suggesting to speakers that they condense their remarks. The convention is ready to vote. chair introduces Mr. Charles Broughton of Wisconsin.
Mr. Chairman, and delegates of the convention, and friends, representing one of the most constructive and liberal states in the Union, I speak for that Commonwealth when I voice appreciation for the recognition given to the farmers in distress, for the laborer with dependents who was out of work through no fault of his own and in need of a job, for the youth of the land through the granting of a new lease of life in conservation camps, for the efforts put forth by the government in protecting depositors and preserving their life savings and the stabilization of banks, to the end that there will never be a reoccurrence of that dark page in history, for the manifold advantages that have accrued to business, great and small, and which is now out of the red, for the preservation of the home in the city, and likewise the farm, and for all of these benefactions. It is a source of pleasure representing the delegation in this convention and speaking for Wisconsin to second the nomination of a great American, a great leader, a man who has kept the faith and held sacred the rights of the people, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Delegate from Wisconsin, following the chairman's request, keeps his seconding speech well within 2 minutes. The limit is tentatively set at 5 minutes, though it hasn't been enforced very well on this day of seconding speeches, which started roughly around 1 o'clock this afternoon. The band plays Hail Wisconsin, the delegates get up for a stretch, and the chairman allows them that liberty as he is about to pound with his gavel, attempting to rush through the rest of the seconding speeches and get the acclamation vote before the audience
Wyoming.
Walks out. Back to the rostrum. Wyoming.
Mr. L.G. Flannery. Mr. L.G. Flannery will speak for Wyoming.
Mr. Chairman and my friends in democracy, my remarks will be just as brief as the hour is late. Wyoming is a land of bright, clear sunshine, and its warmth is in the hearts of our people. We have found a kindred warmth in the great heart of our president. Wyoming is a land of grass-covered, wind-swept plains, where the air is fresh and clean and vigorous. We have found the policies of Roosevelt to be as fresh and as vigorous and as clean as the breezes which sweep our prairies. In Wyoming, we are close to nature, where the problems of living bring us into contact with the fundamental elements, where the range must be ridden in blinding blizzards as well as in the warm sunshine, and where human habitations are many, many miles apart. We have found it to be true that one of the finest and best characteristics any man can have is that of being a good neighbor, ready to stand by when a friend or a stranger is in need. Wyoming had her hour of need, and President Roosevelt stood by. He was a friend and a good neighbor to us. We like good neighbors in Wyoming. I never expect to have a greater honor than this honor of seconding the nomination of Franklin Roosevelt in behalf of all the Democrats, and I verily believe in behalf of most of the Republicans in our state. He has been our friend, and we shall again be his friends in November by an even greater majority than we were in 1932. As the last of the 48 states on the roll call, Wyoming is proud of this opportunity to make it unanimous for President Roosevelt. Philippine Islands, the Honorable Frank Murphy, a great Governor General of the Philippine Islands.
Mr. Chairman, the Philippine Islands gratefully seconds the nomination of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Alaska! The chair. The chair introduces the delegate from Alaska, Anthony J. Diamond.
Mr. Chairman, and ladies and gentlemen of the convention, as a representative of the people of Alaska, I am honored indeed to have the opportunity of seconding the nomination of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Alaska was the first to instruct her delegates for Roosevelt in January 1932 and again in January 1936. We judged right both times. Our batting average is just 1,000%. And the batting average of the people of the United States in nominating and electing Mr. Roosevelt is equally just 1,000%. We of the North feel a modest pride of the contribution we made to Mr. Roosevelt's nomination, slight though it was. For Alaska has made a long stride forward, economically and politically, under this administration. With the advent into the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt, a larger moral and spiritual force came into the political life of the nation. We are urged, indeed we are commanded, to love our neighbors ourselves. But how many of us are able to do it? Surely, surely, anyone who has examined and studied the life and conduct and character of our great president must acknowledge that every act of his political life shows a high spirit of self-abnegation, a love of neighbor that is all too rare in private life and frequently all but absent in the realm of political and economic affairs. As long as the example of the Good Samaritan is deemed worthy of emulation, so long should we honor the man whom we have come here to nominate for the highest office in the gift of the nation. We have just adopted a great platform, concise, clear, certain, definite, embodying the doctrine of the New Deal. But we could have condensed that platform into a single sentence. We could have said it would have been supported by the heart and mind of every member of this convention, by every lover of this of humanity. We could have said, we commend the administration, and we shall support and continue to support with all of our strength the political and economic policies of Franklin D. Roosevelt, for we know that that policy not only embraces the policy of the good neighbor, but the policy of the good Samaritan, the policy of one who loves his fellow men.
District of Columbia. Chair takes pleasure in introducing the Honorable John Walsh, who speaks for the District of Columbia.
Mr. Chairman and fellow Democrats, I am authorized by the delegates from the District of Columbia to give voice to the sentiments of the democracy of the district relative to the nomination for president at this convention. Let me assure you that although the permanent residents of the district are not granted the right of voting franchise, the democracy there is as splendid and as militant as any in the Union, comprising men and women who, without thought of public office or favor, unselfishly and effectively promote in various ways the best interests of the Democratic Party. I may, I hope, be pardoned for here making a personal reference by quoting two sentences from the address of the permanent chairman of the 1932 Democratic Convention. They do, I think, sum up his philosophy of economic justice. He then said, "To what source must the plain people look for a fair division of the products of their labor, multiplied as it has been in this machine age? Only by entrusting the government to those whose constant concern is for the multitude at the bottom, rather than the few at the top, yet eager that justice shall be accorded to all." From that good day that these prophetic words were uttered, Franklin Delano Roosevelt has faithfully responded to that call and word indeed. The change in Washington throughout the country, which this 3.5 years has wrought, is too remarkable and too weighty in its lessons not to be laid to heart. But the limitations upon my time prevent me from speaking all that is in my heart and mind to say. And now that the issue has been met, the people must be the judges. On the record of the administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt, I do, on behalf of the Democrats of the District of Columbia, endorse and second his nomination.
I got a long one to do,
Hawaii, Mr. William H. Heen speaks for Hawaii. Mr. Chairman, I bring to you and to the ladies and gentlemen of this convention and to all the others here assembled the greetings of Hawaii, aloha nui loa kākou. Hawaii, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, seconds the renomination of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as Democratic candidate for re-election to the presidency of the United States. chairman of the delegation from Puerto Rico, Mr. Federico Ball Spinoza.
Mr. Chairman and fellow delegates, deeply grateful, and I emphasize the word grateful, for the great benefits which Puerto Rico has received from the present Democratic administration, both in our beautiful island and to our citizens residing in New York, and fully conscious that the leading spirit in bestowing these benefits has been the great humanitarian residing in the White House, Puerto Rico feels extremely happy to second the nomination of the greatest friend we have had in the 38 years of our association with these United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Panama Canal Zone, Mrs. L.O. King will speak for the Canal Zone.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of this convention, it is an honor and a privilege for me, on behalf of the democracy of the Panama Canal Zone, to second the nomination of one of the greatest humanitarians that history has ever known, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Virgin Islands, Mr. Joseph Alexander will speak for the Virgin Islands.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the convention, the Virgin Islands, not a star in the flag, but nevertheless loyal. 'Tis more than 3 long years since we were euphemistically differentiated as a poor house. But 'tis less than 3 long years since we have had our status defined and a chance given us to emerge from the poor house by opening the gate to prosperity. With the repeal of the 18th Amendment, the gate was unlocked, and during the past 3 years, everything possible has been done by President Roosevelt to keep the gate to prosperity always open. 'Tis but 4 short days since President Roosevelt attached his signature to an act providing for a permanent government for the Virgin Islands, which took more than 12 long years under a Republican administration before the islands could get a hearing. 4 years after the last convention of the Democratic Party at Chicago, the Virgin Islands were among the first to pledge their allegiance to Franklin Delano Roosevelt for the high office of President of the United States. Today, with a record of much accomplished, with a future never so bright, the Virgin Islands are gratified for the second time to second the nomination of Franklin Delano Roosevelt for the President of the United States.
The chair recognizes the delegate from South Dakota to submit a motion.
I move that the rules be suspended and Honorable Franklin Delano Roosevelt be declared the nominee for President of the United States by acclamation.
The chair. Just a moment. The chair will put the question. Order. The question is on the motion
of the delegate from South Dakota that the rules be suspended and that Franklin D. Roosevelt be declared the nominee of this convention for President of the United States. As many as favor the motion will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The ayes have it, and I hereby declare Franklin D. Roosevelt the nominee by acclamation of this convention.
Time is Franklin Delano Roosevelt selected as the Democratic candidate for the highest political office in all the world, the presidency of the United States. And on the scene of the convention floor in Philadelphia is the scene as you imagine it would be after listening to the descriptions of the demonstrations which have been taking place in this hall since the convention was called to order Tuesday at noon by the chairman of the Democratic National Committee and the Postmaster General of the United States, the Honorable James A. Farley. As the last territories were being called and coming up to make the seconding speeches, which was complete, that is 48 states and the seven territories, including the district, as the last ones were coming to the platform, page boys rushed up and down the aisles distributing great square pictures of Franklin D. Roosevelt. They're put on poles and hoisted up before the delegates, and like giant postage stamps, they've been hiding the faces of half the delegates and alternates in this hall as Chairman Robinson put the question. The rules were suspended as moved by Governor Berry of South Dakota, and the convention, by acclamation, chose Franklin D. Roosevelt as the Democratic candidate to succeed himself in the presidency for the next 4 years. This was what was attempted to be done, if we remember correctly, at the Cleveland Convention, but the rules were not suspended in Cleveland, and Chairman Snell had the roll call by states. After the roll had been called and almost all the votes were for Alfred Mossman Landon, the convention then moved that the nomination to Mr. Landon be made unanimous. This nomination, however, was not only unanimous here in Philadelphia, it was by acclamation. Around and around the hall goes the parade of the banners, and how long it will last before this convention can be adjourned tonight is again a matter of pure speculation. All the state signs have been ripped loose and carried about. The pictures of Mr. Roosevelt everywhere are overshadowing the usual painted signs with their slogans, which we've been looking at for so long. There are several cloth banners being unrolled with slogans which we can't even read. Those who left in the balconies, there was, you know, the largest house of the entire convention when the session opened this evening, but due to the long, drawn-out proceedings of all the seconding speeches being broadcast, those in the back of the balcony all went home, and a great many delegates, too, apparently were discouraged and left, leaving the alternates to move up in their places and vote in their stead, should voting be necessary, which, of course, it wasn't tonight. Those in the balconies in the near part who still left throwing paper down, waving and shouting for the photographers. On the rostrum, a great assortment of people have crowded up to pose for the photographers and to stand with hands upraised in the beam of the spotlights. An Indian chief in full regalia with a great feathered headdress is standing holding both hands up and waving to the cameras. You've seen him on the speaking platform all evening. He was even going around drinking frequently from the water cooler on the platform, but he never was presented to the convention as far as I remember, and who he is, I don't know. Here is the news also that we have been waiting to see whether it would happen. That is the demonstrometer which Columbia invented, built, and took first to the Cleveland Convention and then to the convention here in Philadelphia has now recorded 100 acoustical decibels, the highest yet recorded at either convention. 85, if I remember correctly, I'm quoting purely from memory, 85 was the record in Cleveland when Alfred Mossman Landon was placed in nomination.
95 was the record of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in Philadelphia this morning when his name was placed to nomination by Judge John E. Mack of Poughkeepsie. And now, with Franklin D. Roosevelt, officially the candidate of the Democratic Party, 100 decibels, which I believe must be the theoretical top, has been registered on the applause machine. New Jersey, under the leadership of Mayor Haig, 100% for Roosevelt. There's a sign going around with the state banner of New Jersey. A far different scene from the last convention in 1932, which nominated President Roosevelt, then Governor Roosevelt, in Chicago, when Mayor Haig was, before the convention, a bitter enemy of the Roosevelt forces and a leader of the Stop Roosevelt movement. The noise continues. Let's listen to it. Hear how it swells up and hear the band in the background. Because of technical requirements, as we're listening to the noise of the great Roosevelt demonstration, the largest of the convention in Philadelphia, we are to pause for station identification. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
WABC, New York.
Texas are upon you, the eyes of the 48 United States and seven territorial possessions, including the district, as the entire assemblage marches around the convention floor in Philadelphia. The sign that tried so hard last night to make its way down the struggling aisle is back again. The party with a soul, the strange sort of sign decorated with small American flags and the picture of President Roosevelt underneath. Maryland, my Maryland, every one of the states joins in the festivities tonight, for this is the demonstration, to be exceeded only by tomorrow night's festivities when President Roosevelt appears in person to accept the nomination. Down on the speaker's platform once again, Columbia's commentator H.B. Kaltenborn has climbed upon a table to view the proceedings to better advantage, and as we have mentioned many times as this convention proceeded, Mr. Kaltenborn's view is the view of the speakers themselves. Mr. Kaltenborn.
Here we are on the platform looking out on the demonstration, which in spite of the lateness of the hour has all the vigor of the one that greeted the first mention of Mr. Roosevelt's name this morning. It's really a test of human endurance, and I must compliment the delegates who have been sitting here patiently so many, many hours listening to oratory that now, at the close of this long day, they can still get up sufficient enthusiasm to mill around these hot aisles, carrying their pictures, waving their arms, cheering their leaders, and really acting as though they were just full of enthusiasm. Of course, it's been evident to me, as I have watched the reaction of the audience and the various speakers coming on during the past hour, that their patience was wearing thin so far as oratory is concerned. Again and again, speakers were interrupted by applause and by requests to cut it short. As you probably heard the chairman announce, he asked each speaker to keep his speech down, and I could see them struggling desperately with their manuscripts here, trying to reduce them and yet to retain those precious, eloquent periods which they had so carefully prepared and which they were so anxious to give out to what they thought would be an eagerly listening world. But alas, a world that may be listening eagerly at 10 o'clock in the morning, by midnight of the same day when it has been listening steadily, is no longer eager. And so, as you probably noticed, the greatest acclaim of the evening, outside of that to Governor Lehman, went to Governor Frank Murphy of the Philippine Islands when he simply said the Philippine Islands second the nomination of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That brought a weighty cheer from the crowd because that was the kind of speech that the crowd wanted at this particular time. It looks to me as though Chairman Robinson decided that this celebration would probably be going on for some little time. Well, first he left the platform, now he's come back, and he's lit a cigar, and he's comfortably chatting away when he isn't being besieged by the autograph collectors. The autograph collectors have overrun this platform tonight. Even my insignificant self has had to stop every minute or two in order to sign cards. Sometime I think there'll have to be a society for the protection of people against autograph hunters. Now I see over there on the right, they're getting quite excited. A great many banners have been gathered together in one part of the hall. About 30, 40 different states have gathered around one large banner, and I think they're trying to start something very special. In spite of the fact that it is half after midnight, I see that the galleries, especially those near the platform, are still fairly well filled. Way off in the farther recesses of the hall, the galleries are empty, and as they have emptied, people have moved in towards the platform here, so that to my right and to my left, the galleries are still fairly well filled. One thing that's been notable about this convention is that the galleries have been extremely enthusiastic through it all. There has been very much more liveliness, very much more demonstration from the galleries themselves than we had at Cleveland. I think that's partly due to the greater intimacy of the auditorium, which seems to integrate this particular convention. It certainly is helpful when everything can be heard and when there is a close relation of the people to one another. Off the banners go again for another whirl around the hall. The delegates don't seem to tire of it. I look at their faces as they come streaming down the center aisle, and while their faces look a little tired, every now and then they light up, look up towards the platform, wave their banners, and try to express enthusiasm as best they can. I can imagine that they are very thoroughly physically tired, but they have decided that they're going to have this celebration, and they're having it. Off to the right and left, up in the galleries, occasionally we see a little waving. Now and then, paper is torn up and tossed down, although there is less of that tonight than there has been during the rest of the day. A great many of the delegates are now gradually taking their places. It looks to me as though about half of them had begun to sit down, and as though the other half were slowing down. And I rather think that if the chairman pleased, he could probably bring the demonstration to a close now just as soon as he wanted to. However, he undoubtedly has the feeling that after having waited so long a time for their final demonstration in connection with the nomination, that the delegates are entitled to have their fling, and he's letting them have it. And now back to Bob Trout in Columbia's booth.
In Columbia's booth, we've just seen a very interesting sign go floating by, apparently held by some unseen delegate lost in the crowd below. It was the Virgin Islands banner, and underneath it said, Roosevelt before Chicago, a significant emblem. Incidentally, in discussing with you that 100 acoustical decibel record, which is the record set on our demonstrometer for both conventions, I do want to say once again, just as I said this morning when the 95 mark was reached here in the hall, that acoustical differences in the hall, the size of the hall, and all that sort of thing, make it very difficult, if not absolutely impossible, to compare one auditorium, one convention hall with another. The conditions in this hall, undoubtedly, are not quite the same as they were in the Cleveland Convention Hall, and so the comparison is not quite fair. Nonetheless, those are the figures which are recorded on our demonstrometer. 85 for the Landon demonstration at its peak, 95 for the Roosevelt demonstration in this hall this morning when his name was placed in nomination, 100 tonight when he is actually nominated. Incidentally, Mr. Kaltenborn was telling you about how tired out the audience became during this long, long day of seconding speeches by the 48 states and the 7 territories. And I have a little human interest item to tell you in that connection. You know, Emil Hurja, whom Mr. Kaltenborn interviewed a few days ago, is the statistical wizard of the New Deal, and he is supposed to have charts and graphs telling all about the New Deal and how it stands in various states. Back to the rostrum first.
10 o'clock tomorrow. The question is on the motion of the delegate from Missouri. Many as favor the motion, vote aye. Opposed, no, the ayes have it, and the convention stands adjourned until 10 o'clock tomorrow.
And that just about ends the Friday night session. Adjourned, as the chairman says, until 10 o'clock tomorrow. Before going on, I might as well finish that anecdote. I got all the way to the last line, and I was just telling you that during the long, drawn-out seconding speeches this afternoon, we spied Mr. Emil Hurja seated on the speaker's platform, not studying graphs, charts, or records of the statistical strength of the New Deal, but calmly reading the Sunday funny papers. The procession moves around. They're not going to stop so easily. The convention is officially no convention at all now, having adjourned, but nonetheless, the banners are moving around slowly, and the tangle is quite too complicated to be unscrambled and sent home to bed so promptly. It will be several minutes, perhaps a long half hour, before the convention unties itself and gets back to its various hotels for a night of rest
before returning to this auditorium tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, perhaps, as the chairman suggested, 10 o'clock, to nominate John Nance Garner, the favorite son of the Lone Star State of Texas, for the vice presidency of the United States again for a second term. It's pretty hard to tell, too, at this time just how long the nominating of the vice president will take. We understand that Vice President Garner will be in Philadelphia to accept the nomination in person. Then tomorrow night in Franklin Field, as you've heard many times, the President of the United States will come specially from Washington on his special train to Franklin Field, and there before 100,000 spectators will accept the nomination conferred upon him just a few moments ago in this Philadelphia Convention Hall. This confirms the precedent which was started by Governor Roosevelt at the Chicago Convention in 1932, when he shattered all tradition by not only appearing in person, but by taking an airplane from his New York home to Chicago to appear in person and accept the nomination. Tomorrow night, a great many political experts and observers believe that an historical and political drama, very significant in American affairs, will take place, the like of which hasn't been seen, some say, since Abraham Lincoln whipped the Republican Party into the shape which it was to have for many years to come, because a great many political experts feel that a new party is really being born here this week in Philadelphia, although not very much is said about it, and it still retains the name of the Democratic Party. We, of course, are not trying to editorialize, but just telling you some of the talk that goes on in the press galleries here at Philadelphia. Of course, we do know that the right wing, under the guidance of Al Smith, has moved off from the Democratic Party, and a left movement is started with Mr. Lemke as a presidential candidate. So if a new party is to be drawn up, and if new party alignments are last to find their place in the United States, many people think that that movement, that tendency which has been going on for a long time, will find its dramatic high point tomorrow night under the floodlights and amid the band music in Franklin Field at Philadelphia. At any rate, whatever it is, it will be a performance. It will be broadcast over Columbia, which has been bringing you the convention news ever since the Democratic Convention convened at 12 o'clock noon on Tuesday. Chairman Robinson said that it would be 10 o'clock tomorrow morning when this Democratic Convention reconvenes for the purpose of selecting the vice presidential nominee. We have been announcing every time the convention adjourned here that we'd come back on the air at an hour exactly 60 minutes after the hour that the chairman announced. That seemed to be a pretty good procedure to follow, because I don't believe they ever did start before we had figured out the time, that is 1 hour later. I'm not sure just what time we will come back tomorrow. Make it 11. Tentatively, we will make it 11 a.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. Of course, if the nomination should start before that time, you can count on us bringing you the latest news from the convention hall in Philadelphia.